Tonight's discussion is entitled America, a Force for Good in the World. We'll be having two presenters to kind of lay out some of the issues. But what we like to do in the forum is minimize formal presentation and maximize discussion. And please feel free to speak, try to make them concise as possible, and please raise your hand so I could acknowledge you. Otherwise, we get going all over the place and we have five different discussions going at once. Two of the people that are presenting tonight are both on the teaching staff, Jim Nechterlein and John Rosenberg. And Jim, I think, was going to be going first. So it's all yours.
I guess I'm given the not entirely attractive position of sort of defending the affirmative on this point. It arose the other night at a session I gave on hawks and doves and Christians, and I referred to a quotation from Richard Neuhaus, in which he said the most important division among Americans today towards foreign policy is between those who can and cannot agree with the following proposition. On balance, and considering the alternatives, the U.S. is a force for good in the world. And I want to add those qualifiers because I think they're important. On balance, and considering the alternatives, the U.S. is a force for good. First, perhaps the more negative of those two, considering the alternatives. It seems to me that the major alternative to U.S. influence in the world is the influence of the Soviet Union and of the Marxist-Leninist philosophy with which the Soviet Union is associated. The USSR is the alternative to the US. We still live, for all the talk about multipolar power centers in the world, in an essentially bipolar world. The real power, the power that counts, is held on the one hand by the United States, leading the West, on the other hand by the Soviet Union. In the absence of the United States or in its neutralization, we would have the increased dominance, far greater than it is, of the Soviet Union in the world today. And it's my belief that Marxism not in theory, but Marxism in practice, as instigated in the Soviet Union and elsewhere, has been the political scourge of the 20th century. It doesn't exist on a scale of evil up there with Hitler's Germany, though Stalin actually came pretty close to Hitler's Germany in terms of the people he killed. It's really far more insidious in its influence than fascism because it's so much more attractive. Fascism was simply naked power, and we all knew who were the good guys and the bad guys, and the fascists were not the good guys. It's Marxism, Leninism, associated with the United States, is far more insidious because of the high idealism in which it is clothed. It is often a mystery to me why Marxism remains so attractive in many places in the West, given its record. There have been, since 1917, a lot of Marxist governments established in a lot of places, and not one of them is free. They are all dictatorships. They are all places in which there is no democracy, no pluralism, no individual liberty. That, by now, one would think is no accident. And yet, and I can't fully understand this, Marxism continues to have, among many people in the West, the kind of continual benefit of the doubt. It started with the Soviet Union in the 20s and 30s, and people finally began to realize, well, that didn't work out so well. Then it moved to China, and then it moved to Cuba, and then it moved to Vietnam and Cambodia, and none of them have turned out well, and yet, nonetheless, the benefit of doubt remains, especially among some intellectuals and some liberal church groups. I think it's because a lot of people are seduced by the rhetoric. Marxism talks about equality and justice and freedom, and the rhetoric continues to dominate. So we're in the odd, people's perception, so we're in the odd kind of situation where capitalism is based on its record, and often the worst of its record, that is the worst places. People often judge capitalism not on North America or Western Europe, but on the worst examples of it in Latin America or elsewhere. While socialism, on the other hand, is based not on its record, but on its rhetoric, on its ideals, on its promises, and the fact those promises have never been fulfilled anywhere, doesn't seem, among at least some people, to make a heck of a lot of differences. Difference. It still has an enormous attraction, and the United States is the main influence standing in the way of the expansion of Marx, of the expansion of Marxist-Leninist influence. So at the negative level, at one level, we can say the U.S. is, on balance, considering the alternative, a force for good, I think, not because we are particularly virtuous, but because our adversary is a real and powerful opponent of human freedom. To put the case more positively, that is, on balance, the U.S. is a force for good, I'd say very briefly, it's just that. That is, on balance, I think we are a force for good in the world. We're not always right, we're not always just, we're not always wise. The United States, like any nation, is prone to the same temptation to identify its interests with international virtue. We are not a redeemer nation. We are not a people of peculiar virtue. And often, we do not act well in the world. Particularly, there are problems in the third world. The problem so often in the third world, which is where I think the negative view of this proposition would most often arise, the problem in the third world, so often, we don't have good choices. Since World War II, the U.S. hope has been to find a liberal third force. We don't want to attack the we don't want to defend the reactionaries on the right, we don't want to defend the Marxists on the left, we want a liberal third force in between. The problem is, often these third world nations don't have the traditions, they don't have the socioeconomic foundations to have a liberal third force. That is, they lack a middle class. And ever since Aristotle, political philosophers have been telling us the real foundation for democracy and freedom is a strong middle class. So often the socioeconomic conditions aren't there. And what happens is these countries are polarized between far left and far right. And the United States says, all right, we want to fight the influence of Marxism. And so in practice, then, we wind up often supporting what is available to fight the Marxists. And to be frank, what's available is sometimes pretty sleazy. We have to hold our nose. And it may well be the truth that we don't always work hard enough for reform in third world places. But sometimes, as I say, there really are no good choices available to us. And the alternatives to a repressive right-wing government can be worse. Let's remember the Shah. How awful it was we supported him. We should withdraw our support. Well, we did, and we got the Ayatollah. And the people of Iran are not, I think, better off under the Ayatollah than they were under the Shah. Beyond that, making it more positive, I think the U.S. record since World War II is more positive than it's often painted. We have been, in many places, the sustainers and defenders of democracy, of pluralism, of individual liberty. We instituted those things in West Germany. We did it in Japan, the countries we conquered. We are sustainers of it in Europe, and even in Latin America. We have often tried, though often not with much success, to keep those things going. And finally, the last point I'd make, the U.S. supports some repressive governments that are pretty unattractive. But at least those repressive right-wing governments have a potential for evolution towards democracy and freedom. It has happened in Brazil recently. Argentina, Brazil, Uruguay. We're putting pressure in places like Chile and elsewhere. Marxist regimes have never, ever, not once, evolved towards liberty and freedom and democracy. And so I think even though we sometimes do have to hold our nose, we can support them. So that hoping, pressuring, working toward reform and change. And then, so I can say in conclusion that it seems to me that the ideals that America stands for, at its best, democracy, pluralism, freedom, are worth defending. They really are under attack in the world. We really do have adversaries who oppose these things. They're worth our support, if our critical support. And it seems to me that we can say the U.S. is a force for good because if the U.S. were not here, those things would be even in more fragile condition in the world than they now are.
Okay, thank you. John, what do you have to say?
Well, I think I'd probably find myself in a agreement with much of what you've said. But I have a problem with it. And the basic problem I have with it is that it makes an assumption. And I guess the best way for me to talk about that assumption is if you think about current U.S. foreign policy as it's being operative right now, our current foreign policy is ideologically committed to doing just what Jim talked about, to seeing all global issues as either potential or real conflicts between the United States and the Soviet Union. And I'm at this point, I'm not convinced that that's the case. And I think that, depending on whether you see the world in those kinds of terms, that will have something to do with how you answer the question. I don't see the world that way. I think when we view the world that way, as an East-West struggle, that's when we get into the kinds of problems that make us maybe a more of a destabilizing force in the world than a force for good. It implies, I think, that the only alternative, and I think that statement that Newhouse made implies that the only alternative to American hegemony in the world is Soviet hegemony. You know, we've got one or the other. Either if the United States is not exerting its influence, then the Soviet Union will exert its influence. Those are the only two alternatives. And I think when we see those as the only two alternatives, we are prevented then from seeing some other more creative alternatives and maybe some real possibilities for something new. I can think of some examples right now where, in my estimation, the United States could be a force for good in the world, but because we insist on seeing everything in terms of East-West conflict instead of paying attention to other dynamics, we're probably more of a destabilizing and a negative influence rather than a good influence. And I'll just list three of them. The first one has already been alluded to here, and that's Central America. The current administration insists on interpreting the events in Central America as a Soviet-American confrontation. So what's happening in Central America, for the most part, is not being interpreted as being indigenous to Central America, but it's being interpreted as a battleground between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. And the result of that, I think, is that we support a group of mostly, I'd have to say, unreconstructed thugs, not all, but mostly unreconstructed thugs known as the Contras. We're destabilizing a regime, the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, which is actually providing Sandinistas with excuses for withdrawing civil liberties in some cases. We also prop up a regime in El Salvador, which has proven itself again and again incapable of even protecting its own citizens from right-wing death squads. And yet, because of our ideological commitments, we're engaged in both of those kinds of things, and we become a destabilizing influence in Central America. We're part of the problem there instead of part of the solution. Another result of that, I guess, and one that I'm feeling a little more close to this day, as a result of those kinds of ideological commitments, we close our borders to legitimate political refugees, something that we haven't done in the past, and we bug church Bible studies, again, as part of this ideological commitment we have to seeing everything in terms of East-West struggle. We don't see any alternatives. I don't think currently the United States is a force for good in Central America. And I think there is an alternative besides Soviet expansionism down there, and that is the Contadora process, by which nations in Central America are sort of taking responsibility for peace in the region. The problem, as I see it, is that the United States keeps subverting that process and not allowing it to take place instead of getting behind it. So that's one example, I think, where we could be a force for good, but instead we're a destabilizing force. Another example, I think, is South Africa and Namibia. Our current American foreign policy, at least a good bit of it, is tied in Namibia and South Africa, is unrealistically, in my estimation, tied to the presence of Cubans in Angola, which I don't think is really related to what's going on either in Namibia or South Africa. So instead of exerting real pressure on the Botha government, for instance, economic sanctions, which almost everybody says is the way we ought to go in terms of putting pressure on that regime, to get out of Namibia and to establish majority rule in South Africa. Instead, we give the impression, maybe not overtly, but certainly by implication, that we support Botha and thus we support apartheid, which most of us would not support. And yet our ideological commitments in that region of the world have made us appear that way. Once more, we're ideologically committed to reading that situation in terms of an East-West confrontation instead of seeing the indigenous roots of it. And I think that's one that's going to come back to haunt us. I really do believe that. And then finally, as a final example, I think when we look at the whole issue of arms control, both strategic arms control and conventional arms control, our administration, the current administration, is engaged in the greatest arms buildup in anybody's memory right now. We have gone ahead with Star Wars, even though the bulk of the scientific community says it's not going to work. We've recently denounced SALT II. We've piled up an incredible debt as a result of the arms buildup, and we shifted our spending priorities to the militarization of our society instead of other priorities. And I think we've destabilized not only the American economy, but other economies as well. And all over the world, we're selling arms to people and destabilizing situations that we should be maybe stabilizing. The result, I think, is that we've got a nuclear arms race, we've got global instability, we've got the threatened economy at home and abroad, and we have a failure, I think, in our administration because, again, we see things in terms of East and West to reduce arms and to disarm the world. We've got a threat to life, and we refuse to see that nuclear arms represent a different dimension. And so by treating Gorbachev's Russia as though it were the same as Joe Stalin's Russia, I think that we're a destabilizing force in the world instead of a force for good. So on balance, and considering a host of promising alternatives, I would say, the U.S. is presently, I think, a destabilizing force in the world rather than the force for good that it could be. So let me stop there.
Well, you've heard two articulate positions made with some agreement and I think much disagreement there, which is what I was hoping for. And now
we really like each other.
And now it's your turn to react to them or to each other on this question. They set the stage for us. Any comments from you? Yes, over here.
One thing you say about the arms race that a lot of people seem to don't seem to realize is that the Russians have proven by all possibilities that they simply cannot be trusted, that they are actually ahead of us in the Star Wars initiative and may be so far ahead of us that if we don't catch up, they may attack and wipe us off the face of the earth. I mean, I think that the possibility of a nuclear war and a Russian victory is within something that may happen in the next 3 years, and I think we have to arm ourselves in order to just go on living.
On what basis do you think they have this superiority? Why do you think?
One book I read was very interesting by Yuri Suvorov, who wrote Inside the Red Army, and I would recommend that you read that book. It's too complicated to discuss just a few minutes here, but I would recommend that you read it and then see for yourself.
Sure, coming home. Thank you.
All Russian nuclear power plants are designed to produce weapons of plutonium. How many of our nuclear power plants produce weapons of plutonium? None. Well, that is just for that single purpose. That's what it's for. We have one, yes. But every Russian nuclear power plant is designed to produce.
Please raise your hand. Okay. Not at you, but otherwise we're going to get all over the place.
In the balcony.
Yes.
I think Big Mountain is a prime example of our U.S. government catching up and moving the Indians off to mine the plutonium down there. I mean, they're trying to catch
it. Right here and then back to you.
Just a couple of things you just talked about. Main areas. One thing, a lot of people talk about how Reagan is doing this massive defense budget, and you know we have this big deficit. As if the defense budget was the main problem, if people just look at the figures, will realize that in proportion to how big the budget is, John F. Kennedy spent a lot more than Reagan did. Other presidents have. They weren't perceived as that because Reagan has a steady hand. communism. A lot of people automatically use that against him. He mentioned kind of contradiction. For one thing, like South Africa is a good example. Some people think that America should do everything it can to try to get rid of voter, which I happen to agree with. But then when it comes to a place like Nicaragua, where Somoza government was overthrown, we supported this Sandinista government. When it turns out they're not what they're supposedly going to be, then we try to get them out in the same way we try to get voter out. But then people say, well, Nicaragua, that's different. And I think there's a lot of places in the world where people make that difference. Well, you see, that's a different country. You know, South Africa, well, yeah, we have to go against South, these other countries. Well, I don't know. If they're repressive, yes. They take away civil liberty, but, you know, and they add these buts to all these places. Nicaragua's a good place. But people think El Salvador is a worse place now than it was before. I think they're fooling themselves. And...
Did you have a third point there, too?
Yeah,
point?
Third point. I think it's just all tied to the same thing, where a lot of people, I was born in Canada, so just naturally I've been sort of anti-American, much of it's above my dad. So I don't have this vision of America. So I see it I see a lot of times where Americans go, well, you know, if America just does this, we can do this and we can do that, as if America is some savior nation. And I don't think it is. But in the same way that a lot of people attack America for everything it does, everything America does and any other country, the matter in some cases is not right. In some cases, America has made major mistakes. Vietnam was a good example of a situation where America just didn't do what it should have done. And so people should protest and should complain about these places. However, then when other countries, whether it be Soviet Union, whether it be other countries such as that, when they do the same thing, it is often ignored. Because then people say, well, that's out of our control and we have no right to say this. And so I think, I don't see anything wrong with, I think America in places is good, in places it's bad. But I think if people are going to criticize, they should criticize everyone, not just America, which I hear a lot, America did this, America is doing this, this is awful. They should criticize the Soviet Union just as much. Soviet Union now just stepped up bombing of Afghanistan, much as America did in Vietnam, you hear nothing. Soviet Union is sending all these new supplies to Nicaragua, Nicaraguans attack Honduras, you hear nothing. So if people are going to criticize America, which they should also criticize it wherever it happens, no matter who's doing it. And I think that's a major problem.
I simply want to announce that neither my son or I are responsible for each other's opinion.
Oh. You didn't know that, Dave. That's father and son over here. A Canadian and an American, or dual citizenship, I guess, over here.
I think to equate our efforts in the Strategic Defense Initiative with the arms race is a mistake. But in fact, I truly believe, having had some association with that program, that in fact it is a defensive measure to defend ourselves and our nation, and hopefully other nations as well, against ICBM attack. The fact that there are a lot of scientific minds who have predicted that we may not meet the full success of the program, I suspect is a common thing that happens with respect to a lot of projects. As a matter of fact, when the intercontinental ballistic missile was being developed in this country, perhaps about 40 years ago, some of the best scientific minds in the country said it would never work, it would be totally infeasible. And that Dr. Vannevar Bush was one of those who spoke out and said it was just a waste of money for us to pursue that program. He was proven wrong, as a matter of fact, because the guidance system that we were able to develop it before it had far more accuracy than he ever believed was technically feasible. I think that there are a lot of good scientific minds around when Columbus decided to make his journey, who decided that wasn't feasible either. So the fact that there are a lot of respected individuals, for example, who are saying that they think that it will be unsuccessful, doesn't necessarily prove that we should not be investing in it, because there are a lot of side benefits to pursuing these programs that we may, in fact, not even be able to visualize today that will be coming from.
I'm concerned about the fact that SDI is considered a defensive system when there's so much to the contrary that it would be an offensive system. Can you help me with that?
Well, there's no way in which SDI could be offensive in a sense that it can't be used in a first mode. It has to be used in a reactionary mode. It's not effective in a first mode.
People have explained it that way, though. I mean, I've read things, scientists have said that there is an offensive, or it could be used as an offensive way.
Yeah. Well, do you have a point on this?
The fact is, in our discussion, we concerned that it's destabilizing, because if it is truly defensive, and the Russians are what many people claim they are, for which I have some doubt, they will attack first before we can possibly get the system working. Now they will do something, because if it really is going to be defensive and prevent their nuclear weapons from functioning, that will destabilize the whole situation and cause everything to be up for grabs, as long as it's got its balance. But if we get ahead in terms of preventing them, then they will be ineffective. It'll really destabilize. That's the argument.
In fact, based on what John said, another way of asking this question is not, is it a force for good, but is America a force for stabilization or destabilization in the world? Maybe another way of asking the same question. I don't know if you would agree with that or not, but I just pose that because of these comments and what he laid out. Here and then here?
Yeah, just on the point of SDI, and I have no idea whether it's going to work or not, and I'm not sure it'll be worth it. It seems to me it's worth doing the research to find out. But on the question of destabilization, that, you know, if the Russians think it'll work, they'll be so scared because we'll have the ultimate defense that they'll be prompted to issue a first strike before we get it in place. But that means they'd be committing suicide. I can't believe the Russians would do that, because they know we can destroy them. It doesn't make sense for them. I mean, they may be afraid of it. I would grant that. But I find it hard to believe that in response to that fear, they would then issue a first strike because they know we can destroy them.
But if I lived in Reagan's rhetoric world about that, what would you do if you felt that kind of a world was organizing against you? You really have to do something.
I suppose if I thought Star Wars would work, I'd do my own.
Might be a rat. I'll grant you got some weight on your point.
Right here.
If we go out on the concept that we want to destroy the world in order to save it, secondly, I think we have been fighting the effects all the time, and that's what it's called. We react to the effects in Latin America, what is going on, but we never were after the cause of the injustice which made these people choose communism. If you live in an unjust society, I mean, are you going after freedom and the Bill of Rights? If you're hungry, I mean, if your family has famine, are you believing in the Constitution of the United States or in the Second Reich? And who's giving the right? There is much more to it than just seeing two power struggles. And if we believe that our security is in power, then we can go back to history and learn a lot.
I've been in the Soviet Union, and I know that their definition for freedom is different than ours. Theirs is freedom from hunger, freedom from housing problems, freedom from having children being taken care of, freedom from. Ours is freedom to do. And so the two different definitions of freedom, we fight in the different definitions. I know a woman that was married to a Soviet that lived in Chicago, and her husband died because of an accident, and she could not support her children here in the city of Chicago, so she went back to the Soviet Union to live and raise her children because she had the freedom from want living over there, and it was better than having want in Chicago.
Yes, over here.
I have to disagree with that panel on the fact that it has not been proven that the Soviet Union has ever been free from hunger at all, much less free from any of the other things. 18 crop failures in the past 20 years will attest to that. If they're so free from hunger and free from having to care for their kids because they're not able to take, well, maybe then why should the government take care of their kids in the first place? I wouldn't want the government taking care of mine.
I agree, but think of single women in America and how much money they make. and how they can raise their children on that. I mean, I just want you to think of two different ways of defining freedom, that's all.
But Father Sullivan is free from home. Yeah, we're not either.
In one case, she said it helped, but maybe not in all cases, I don't know. Here and then here.
I've got an interpretation of the situation that's been developing. It is that it's clear the third world is in trouble. It's in trouble health-wise, it's been in trouble. Food-wise, it's been in trouble. Education-wise, theoretically, as a Christian nation, we believe that we ought to take care of the world. Now, some of our leaders say we don't. We want to take care of, we want to protect our own interests. But nevertheless, if a Christian nation, no question that the is to be a part of everybody in the world. That's the Christian principle. Everybody's suffering is our suffering. Now, if you don't do anything about other people's suffering, which in many ways we have not done too much about the suffering, really, seriously, then you feel guilty. And you feel guilty, how do you get rid of your guilt? By destroying anybody else and denouncing anybody else who tries to go in and do something. So whatever you like, whatever you think about Cuba, they had 11,000 doctors out around the world that they pay the salary of. You know, I'm not trying to justify Cuba, but there is a thrust in the socialist countries toward taking care of the rest of the world. You could say they take care of it for political reasons. Cuba has 28,000 people from other nations in being educated at their expense in their country. Again, you can say it's all for propaganda purposes, but they're doing that. Now, why do we not do those kinds of things? For the last 15 years, I said what we need is an alternative to the socialist program in the world that will help take care of the needs. We do not have that alternative. We have never really seriously tried to do it. And so, this is the theory. In our guilt, we've got to destroy and denounce anybody who really tries seriously to do it. And I think that the socialist, and I separate Marxism a little from socialism, the socialist doctrine, however dependent it is on Marx, almost everything we think we made in this country is somehow influenced by the Marxian notion that the social conditions are important factors in determining what we are. I think we have to destroy them. I can't understand the vehemence with which we attack every effort of anybody left of center to do anything constructive in the world unless we have that deep sense of guilt. I just can't figure out why it is so vicious against anybody else who's trying to do something. Why we have to identify them with them and can't give other attempts to solve the problem of the world, and many of them have been nationalists, at least in all interpretations of the reading I've done, and not simply Marx. They've been nationalists. They've really tried to deal with this problem from the point of view of the nation. They don't want to be. There are a lot of unaligned nations, and we force those unaligned nations, in many cases, to go to the USSR because it's the only help, because we will not support really a left of center regime anywhere for very long.
Before I call on you, is there anybody, unless you have it, want to respond to that statement? You want to okay, and then over here.
Just part of it. One thing I assume is that every elected leader is a Christian, which I'm not sure I wanted to back up, but just besides that, every time America, it seems, attempts to try to send even humanitarian aid, Nicaragua is a good example, everyone assumes, or people say, well, that's not what you really want, and they don't allow it to pass Congress. people in Congress go, well, you don't really want to give aid. So a lot of it is what America tries to match in. They just say, well, you're intervening. You know, America doesn't have that right to intervene in Nicaragua and give humanitarian aid or any of that Nicaragua or other places in the world. I just, you know, a lot of he says, okay, for one thing, just to get off that, although I do say the same thing, that when America tries to give humanitarian aid to these places, it doesn't work, and especially if you're giving humanitarian aid to a dictatorship, if any of that money is taken by the dictator, then it's used as an example, well, America is not really trying to help this country, besides the fact that dictators steal money from communists as much as Americans. Just to change subject just a little from that, what I was going to say before, but for one thing, she talked about how people in the Soviet Union don't want from hunger, which I disagree with, seeing that they have to wait 5-6 hours in line just to get one single loaf of bread, a very small one, about this big. And not even a loaf of bread, actually, it's about half a loaf, and you have to wait 6 lines just to get that. If that's freedom from hunger, well, I have to disagree with that. One of the good reasons that Soviet Union has all this so-called food is because America sells food to the Soviet Union. They trade with the Soviet Union. They have free trade with the Soviet Union. But no one says America is supporting the Soviet Union by this. And so just to touch on the thing that he said, that Mr. Rosenberg said at the beginning that I have to disagree with, he says by what if we don't pull out all the companies from South Africa or any other nation such as that, we're supporting that country. Well, that's ridiculous. If America didn't trade with every single country that was not a totally free country, America wouldn't have too many people left to sell anything to. So I think to say that because America does this in South Africa, does it in other countries like Libya, does it in countries like this, America is supporting that government. Well, I think that's a strange way to look at the situation. America doesn't support the Soviet Union by giving them food. It does it just because it's part of the American system to trade with other countries.
Let's try to focus at least where I think we maybe should focus, and if you disagree, that can be the point about stabilizing and destabilizing, not so much how bad or how terrible it is in the Soviet Union. It may be bad, but does that justify us to produce a more stable or less stable influence in the world because of that? And that may be a debatable point. And then the point, which I think we still don't want to drop in, if you had a comment to his question, or do you want to yield now?
I think I'll yield at this point.
Okay.
I think it just seems to me it's the balance or the equilibrium that you put into the numbers. I just believe that the world is so complex that to come to any firm commitment to aspect of it makes it very difficult. I mean, on the stabilization or destabilization factor, I think, in spite of that, America still is a great force for them. I look at what they've done in history and over time, the Marshall Plan, the lending of money to the great sums of third world powers. And the number of people we receive into our country, if they take the walls down in the rest of the world, why is it a mass immigration of almost impossible campus? So, in fact, I think these are places in the world that make it difficult for them to understand, except for those who actually go on. And saying, we get reports back, and the problem is we get both positive and negative reports. And trying to understand I forget what I read recently about the fact that politicians give information to the press, and then when it gets back to them, that's a difficult time understanding what's happened, what's been said. So I guess to leave it at that, okay. I'll try and see that.
There's a bunch of hands going up, and what I want us to do is try to keep your comments, you know, as specific as possible. And if you have a question or a statement or a concern, just state it as such, as brief as possible. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and we'll see where we are after that. 1.
Well, I just
there's a subtle point here, I think, and it's important for people to keep it in mind. And the point that I'm trying to make, I think, is not that America, the United States, is a force for evil in the world, or that the Soviet Union is a force for good in the world. What I'm trying to say is, I think, that we have a perception problem, and the perception problem is that we tend to see every situation in the world as an East-West confrontation. And I think that that gets in our way. And I think that because we see things all over the world in terms of East-West confrontations, and instead of judging them on whatever kinds of complexities may be inherent and taking them on a case-by-case basis, in situations where we could be a force for more positive influence in the world, we become a more negative influence or a more destabilizing influence. And the thing that gets in our way is that perception that, aha, these are the Soviets again. And that's what I think the problem is. So that's...
Who are you two?
I was just... It's interesting that you kind of redefine the question. In terms of the destabilizing or stabilizing, which makes it more of a political question. And I think, of course, for good, you find that there's some morality involved. And when we talk about stabilization, destabilization, it means all these politics. And I think there's, in this day, which is a Christian setting, I think there's more to it than that. So I wouldn't call it nation Christian nation. I think, as both of us are Christians, we look at it in both ways.
Okay, who's three? Whoever's three, speak.
In regards to third world countries, and taking a look at our foreign policy, maybe either the gentleman or anybody else could react to this. What is our foreign policy based on, especially in third world countries? Is it a reaction to situations that are present there? Or is it really supporting certain, from a historical perspective, certain things that have been taking place for 50, 60, 70 years, maybe in terms of Central America? Are we really using our foreign policy to protect our vested interests or a capitalistic system, a system that we think should be modeled after us? Are we reacting to situation?
Anybody want to answer that?
Anybody
want to answer that specific?
Well, I assume our motives, like any other nation's motives, are mixed. I mean, sure, we're furthering our own interests, I think, in countries around the world, including trading, strategic, military. Any great power throughout history always has done that. I assume they always will. Finally, you make decisions among great powers on the balance of what it is they're trying to establish, and on balance of what the record is. Just one point on what John was saying briefly, that I don't want to monopolize this, but I didn't mean to say that everything is an American Soviet problem, but I do think that Marxist-Leninist philosophy is a lot broader than the Soviet problem. I mean, China is not an ally of the Soviet Union these days, but it's not a very attractive country either.
Hey, you go there and see. I've been there 2 years ago. The billboards are selling washing machines and sewing machines now, not philosophy.
There's debate on that issue, and it may be another real worthy forum. Daniel. Said you can challenge that, and we had a good challenge over here,
yeah.
So I'm willing to yield.
I would challenge that. I mean, I think there's places around that the risk is sounding like a radical that opting for trying to create stability would be equal to opting for the status quo, and the status quo isn't good. I think if you take El Salvador, if you really study the issue, and this is my second major point, is that we throw around a lot of generalities, but Americans in general haven't done their homework on what's really going on in these countries. Take Nicaragua, for example. This young man is firmly under the opinion that because, I don't know why exactly because, but I believe that if you take the record of what the Sandinistas have done down there and throw away, Washington's rhetoric about how terrible Nicaragua is under the Sandinistas, you'll find that they've done a lot. Now, they're not perfect. They've got some torture chambers, too. But if you line them up next to what the Contras' agendas are, you look at their health programs, their nutrition programs, their programs in all social areas, and you go down there and you talk to the people, are you happy now compared to under Somoza? There'd be no
question that, you know, they wouldn't go back to Somoza for anything. And that's what they'd be back to under the country. So my two major points are, don't look at stability versus non-stability. There are some places that we actually need to create or constructively create some non-stability in the short run to get to a moral position in the long run. And number two, study our issues. We don't know our issues when we talk about these things. We get in a big political debate before we even know the facts.
I agree with that.
Is there anybody up here? Well, I just realized there are people up here.
Yeah, want to say something? I got one here.
Okay, up here.
For Dan, and one of the assumptions that we have, the problem with, I think, as a culture, is the thing about pluralism. And that is, when we start talking about our founding fathers, you know, we think Christian. And we can lapse into something that's not very pluralistic. In fact, this country has been in the last 5 years in terms of thinking that we are basically founded on just Christian principles, or that all the people that founded this country were Christians. And that's very difficult, you know, we're looking at this moral thing, but that's an assumption that we follow as a culture, which takes away from the pluralism that we so dearly love, that we're talking about the Jews, talking about, you know, a whole multi-group of people that we want to respect as a nation. Like Dan, that kind of comment on that.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, I wasn't saying that our founding people were Christians. Some rather good humanitarian principles.
I was mentioned earlier also.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, prior to coming here a few weeks before, my mind was trailing off on a subject which kind of matches this, but not quite in line with your notions of where to go. Over the years, since I've been alone by myself, periodically I've watched television and then I'll put it away, and then I'll watch it again and put it away. And my mind was digesting the material that I've been accumulating from watching television over the last month to see what's going on again. And I concluded that if I were a person from another country looking at what we have in this country to do, that I would, and then I were to extrapolate what I see there to the validity of our putting ourselves forward as something to be good in the rest of the world, I might conclude that what we're doing elsewhere in the world isn't all that moral, because what we see here in this country isn't all that moral. And I'm suggesting that we may need to clean up our act here in order that what people observe going on in this country can then be extrapolated by them to be believable as moral elsewhere. I don't think that a citizen in the Soviet Union viewing the junk that goes on in our country, on our screen, for instance, would be very impressed with what we hope we're doing somewhere else. And I think I might be an enemy of the United States if I were a citizen in another country looking at the junk that goes on in here, too.
I agree. I'm so disgusted, and I look at the junk and I can't see.
That's dangerous.
Yeah, right here.
The danger is, of course, equating what we see presented to us by a rather select number of people who run the TV media with what this country truly represents. And I suggest that the junk that we see on TV is foisted upon us in part, and is appealing to the lowest common denominator in our nation, and is not representative of what this country really truly is.
Dot, and then back here, and then back here, people who haven't said some things yet. So one, two, three.
There is, of course, also the fact that what we see on TV is more representative of all the range of things that are part of this society than is often the case in countries that don't have freedom of information. So equating our junk with some philosophy about some other countries is not necessarily something that's the same thing.
I think what we're seeing on television is a reflection of the incredible mediocrity that we seem to have fallen to. And it troubles me, and we saw a very, very brilliant, although probably not very adept politician, Jimmy Carter, get shellacked by a second-rate movie actor, you know, twice, and his predecessor. And I think that's a sad statement about sort of general sort of malaise that sort of seems to be infesting our way of going about things. And I think it has an image, it presents an image to the world that kind of troubles me.
Might be another great debate. Just scratch out America and put TV down and ask the same question. Yeah, over here.
Yes. I guess what's really disappointing to me is how we as human beings deal with such a complex issue. And we deal with it oftentimes like bullies deal with it in the playground. I do this, and you do that. If you do this, I'm going to do this. And I think if there's anything that we really need to do as people is to really try and understand each other and understand what's going on. And we have very little sense of what Russia is, and they have very little sense of what we have. And I think that, I don't know, it's difficult for a society to put this kind of vision into it, but I would like to think that we could survive long enough so that we put the money that was going into Star Wars into education and understanding, that maybe there will be more payoff.
I want to call on myself. Is that legal? I'm going to do it. I know, right. Capitalistic America, I think, somehow has created the myth of the individual. And how individualism works is kind of over against another. And it's a very competitive thing. And I wonder why, how that is. I think that is different than what at least I perceive the Eucharistic community to be all about. And I just wonder how we incorporate that with who we are as the body of Christ. So, but now I'll... Okay, one, and then we'll let you de-develop it or develop it further wherever you want.
Trying to understand our national policy, I had one piece about our guilt. The other piece is about a kind of mild approach to life is over instrumental bias. It's also something that I experience in my work, and I'm trying to understand the people. The people I work with, and as I experience our national leadership in many places, begin by being mistrusting of everybody, almost everybody. They don't trust other people. They are suspicious of other people. They believe that other people are really out to further their own nest and to get power and position and money and wealth, and that they don't have good motive, and they couldn't possibly have a good motive and be interested in general welfare, be interested in them or another nation as well as themselves. And the result is they form this kind of interactive process which is adversarial, and which if you win, I lose. There's no win-win. If you win, I lose. And so I've got to win. And if you hurt me, I've got to hurt you. I can't possibly absorb your disdain or your ill will and do something else. It has to be counteracted. And I think it stems from a view of the world. I'm getting to your point. In the first place, it stems from a view of the world in which there are isolated individuals. Habits of the Heart builds us up too. It's a new book that just builds us up as being American. What they call ontological individualism, where the real thing in the world is the individual. The real thing in the world for some people is America. Or the United States. That's the only real thing that we're protecting or interested in. It stems from that. Now, on the other hand, there's a view that we are parts of each other. and that therefore life is ambiguous, to be sure, and we're a mixture of good and evil motives. But you assume this mixture, and you assume you can establish some conditions in the world where the good motive will emerge as over against the evil, or there'll be a tendency in that direction. Now, the only way I've been able to live with the people I work with, and some of the people I live with, and with the national leadership, is to assume that this way, at least, interprets what is going on. And I'm not saying that either way is absolutely right, but it does seem to me, I can just see it, that people approach life differently. They just approach life differently. And I cannot understand what's going on in many speeches and many expressions of our national leadership and in many interpretations of other nations without assuming those kind of two diametrically views of life.
Time for two more questions, and then we'll have a formal break, and we can continue later. Bella's book is in the bookstore just to the right of the cash register.
I'd like to re-echo and go back to what the young lady behind me said here, and that is that a group of Christians here to learn more about the Lord and what His Word tells us. I think that a proper focus perhaps would be to try to relate what we're talking about back to morality. I think it's important for all of us to remember that one of the hallmarks of any communist regime is the total suppression of religious liberty, and particularly the fact that the state absolutely rejects the presence of God. It is totally an atheistic philosophy, and that wherever it's been imposed, eventually they will do their best either to create a puppet church, which is totally under the control of the state and therefore does whatever the state tells it to do, or it likes completely.